From the auditorium of the State Department building in Washington, NBC News presents a news conference with Vice President Lyndon Johnson. This is Robert Abernathy. Mr. Johnson returned to the United States this morning from a two-week mission of reassurance to six nations of South and Southeast Asia, where communist pressure has been steady, especially in South Vietnam. Immediately after his arrival here, the Vice President went to the White House, where he reported his findings and recommendations to President Kennedy. The President called the Vice President's trip a great public service. Now the Vice President is walking into the auditorium here with his wife, Mrs. Johnson, and with two or three aides, taking his position behind the podium.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have just reported to President Kennedy and to his distinguished and able Secretary of State, Mr. Dean Rusk, on our fact-finding mission to Southeast Asia. At the President's request, I shall give a further report before the Cabinet tomorrow. He gave me about 45 minutes of his time this morning, and I discussed some of the details of our mission. I made some military and some non-military recommendations, which the President and the Secretary of State, Mr. Rusk, may use as they see fit. I think you, ladies and gentlemen, understand that not all of these recommendations can be discussed here today, because they go to the very heart of survival, not only for the nations of Asia, but for the United States of America as well. Yet there is much that the American people must know and must understand if they are to help their government to meet the awesome challenges before us. So I intend to discuss, with your permission today, to the extent possible, the dangers and the disturbing situations which confront our country. In all of Southeast Asia, I found serious concern about the activities of the communists in Laos and South Vietnam. There was worry as to how to counter the vicious tactics of murder and intimidation now being employed there against innocent people. There was concern that the assault on South Vietnam would broaden and that communist-led agitation would spread from Laos into Northeast Thailand. The campaign of terror by communists who lurk in the shadows by day and who do violence by night convinced me that we must move boldly, immediately, to effectuate President Kennedy's plea that we find new and much more effective ways of dealing with this serious threat. Our mission covered nearly 30,000 miles. We met with President Jim in Vietnam, with President Garcia in the Philippines, with President Chiang in the Republic of China, with Prime Minister Sirip in Thailand, with Prime Minister Nehru in India, and with President Ayub in Pakistan. I have not returned with any miraculous solutions, but I am confident that each of these gentlemen has provided ideas and proposals which merit our President's most serious consideration. I am equally sure that the letters from President Kennedy that I delivered to each leader have pointed the way to the cooperation that is essential if we are to banish the totalitarian dictator menace. While I must point out that Asia still is a troubled continent, easily victimized by those who stand to profit from pitting Asian against Asian, I do believe that our visit increased stability in the area. I should like to share with you these other observations. Communism is not riding a tide of inevitable triumph in Asia. If the lands we visited, Asians have both the will to resist tyranny and the determination to make whatever sacrifices are called for. Two, mine was not a giveaway mission. In fact, the peoples of Asia did not ask for all that I was empowered to promise or to give. On the contrary, one country already has said, as a result of our mission, that it will provide more of its own resources to develop its capability of repulsing the communist threat. Three, I was disturbed that so many Asian leaders should express doubt as to the United States' intention. Some are afraid that the danger of atomic attack has produced a stalemate in which the system that is most unscrupulous are willing to stage the biggest bluff will triumph. I think that they know now that no amount of peril is going to cause the United States to shrink away as human liberty is stifled in Asia. The Asian leaders to whom I talked have been reassured that we in America shall honor America's commitments. Fourth, while I made it clear at President Kennedy's request that we shall make any sacrifice, risk any danger that the protection of liberty may call for, nowhere in Asia was there a request that we send American troops. The free nations of Asia have the manpower. What they told me they wanted from us is the financial support and the technical guidance that will make it possible for their own troops to meet an unscrupulous enemy whose stock weapon is terror and whose favorite target is the men, women, and children who sleep innocent and unknowingly in the villages of the countryside. Five, I concluded, and most Asian leaders agreed, that the current piecemeal approach to the area's problem is ineffective. Free nations need to unite on a broad regional basis, not only militarily, but in the fields of economic justice and social progress. Six, this journey convinced me that never has it been more important that the Congress and the American public support the efforts of free Asians to banish the curse of poverty and illness and illiteracy. I know that given something for which to fight, the peoples of Asia will man the ramparts of freedom and they'll man them with valor. But you know, as they do, that people do not fight in the steaming jungles to preserve hunger and squalor and oppression. The leaders to whom I talk now understand that any economic assistance that this administration provides must be clearly matched in terms of the efforts and sacrifices of the recipient people. We made it clear that social and governmental reforms must be part of any effective anti-communist program, and that the benefits of economic development must go directly to the masses rather than to the dictators and the aristocrats. Eighth, in any event, the ultimate fate of Southeast Asia is going to be determined largely by the imagination and the guidance of Asian leaders and the cooperation that we give. I think it's safe to say that while the Asian people themselves will play key roles, what happens to Southeast Asia within the next year or two is going to be determined also by Americans like you and me. Beyond these observations, I would like to add briefly several additional comments. I was surprised by the vigor we found in the economies of most nations visited. I was gratified to see the importance attached to social progress by each of the leaders we met. I was pleased to see the emerging role of women in the political and social leadership of these nations. I was strengthened and made proud by the degree of faith in and the trust for the United States, which I found among both the people and their leaders. I heard great admiration spoken in each country for our President Kennedy and for our distinguished Secretary of State, Dean Rusk. I return more convinced than ever that the United States has yet to fill the full potential of its influence and leadership for freedom in the world. To accomplish what we can and what we must accomplish, we must not cling to approaches of the past. We must get out of the air-conditioned and stately comforts and go among the people as the friendly, straightforward men and women the world believes that we are in America and that we in America want to be. There's an election being held in this world today between freedom and communism. We must go out seeking votes for freedom as though nothing else were more important, because actually nothing is. I'm grateful for the trust that President Kennedy and Secretary of State reposed in me and my mission. I think that we have achieved what they hoped we would. I have especially thanked the President for the presence on this trip of his sister Jean and her able husband, Steve Smith. Jean and Lady Bird were tireless in their labors in each country, and their examples were worth more than thousands of words. I cannot stress too strongly how valuable it was as evidence of the President's interest to have a member of his family with us. And I think that in the 8 to 9 countries that we visited, that all the leaders of those countries and the people also gathered that this new administration had new approaches and we hope would get new and satisfactory results. I should like to present to you some of the members of our party who spent this 2 weeks of adventure with us. First, I want you to know Lady Bird. And Mr. Carl Rowan, Mr. George Reedy, and Mr. Steve Smith. And now I'll be glad to attempt to answer any questions, if you have any, if you'll give me your name. And
Vice President Holtz, United Press, you spoke in your fifth point of the need for developing of a regional cooperation to deal with these challenges, criticizing the piecemeal approach. Can you be more explicit as to what you have in mind? Are you thinking of a regional organization or of American aid on a regional basis?
Well, I said so that we may start on what is criticism and what isn't. I concluded, and most Asian leaders agreed, that the current piecemeal approach to the area's problem is ineffective. I think that each country has something to offer the other. I think that they realize that they have a common interest. I think that they understand that if men are to fight in the jungles and in the 110-degree sun, that they are not going to fight for a lower standard of living, for opportunities that are only there now, and there must be social reforms that will give them a better opportunity to educate their children, to improve their health, to have better housing and better schools. We all felt that by an exchange of ideas and views, that could be accomplished. We hope that our President and our Secretary of State will give additional consideration to it, and that perhaps we could, down the road, if they approve, have a meeting of all the nations of the Pacific, all the nations of Asia, where one could discuss what they've done in housing, another could discuss what they've done in land reform, another could discuss what they've done in education, another could discuss what they had done in health, and we could reason together and thus make a much more a determined and effective attack on poverty and disease and illiteracy, all of which are the greatest allies the communists have.
Reported during your journey that you had suggested a meeting between the president and Asian leaders. Is that correct? If so, when, where, and for what purpose?
No, that is not correct. We stated in a communique that was issued from Karachi that we felt that it should be considered and developed the idea of having the leaders of all the nations of the Pacific come together and exchange viewpoints, as I had exchanged viewpoints individually with each of the nations. I just covered that and the thoughts behind it in the answer to the previous question. Could very well be, if it was concluded and determined that it would be desirable for heads of state to attend that meeting, I'm sure that if President Kennedy could and would attend, that he could make a great contribution, as I'm sure the heads of state of all the nations concerned would.
I think I know the answer to this, Vice President, but I think we'd like to hear your answer. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial in which it asked if you were in favor of socialism. And this was based on your remarks in India that we were going down different roads but to the same objective. And the Wall Street Journal raised the point that socialism was the opposite of freedom in economics and freedom in politics, and asked if you were in favor of socialism. And I thought you might like to answer.
No one knows better than the Wall Street Journal that I'm not. That's first. Second, I know this, and I hope they do, and all other thinking people, that in a community or in a nation or in a world where one individual is affluent and the others are impoverished, that something can and should and must be done about it. I think that the work that we're doing in cooperation with the friendly peoples of the nation I listed will not only prevent communism from enveloping those areas or socialism, but I think it will offer a great deal of hope to every boy and girl that is born in those countries. I think that we have a long ways to go in improving the standard of living in the nations we visited. Most of them have an annual income of less per year than you have in 1 week. So there's a great deal of improvement that can take place. Housing is non-existent and substandard in many places. Disease is rampant. We are making great strides in attacking illiteracy. One of the nations has 99% of their children in school. Another has only 15%. At the end of their five-year plan, they hope to have 60% of their children in school. So together, we're trying to evolve ways and means for freedom-loving countries, to educate their young, to provide security for their aged, to give a decent a standard of living for their workers, put a roof over the heads of their families, and to do it without enveloping the communist philosophy. We think that we can make progress in that direction, and we don't think, because we try to, that we're either communists or socialists.
Tyson, UPI, you said that we must get out of our air-conditioned comforts and go among the people. Is there going to be any follow-through directive from the administration instructing our own people in these countries to do just that, to spend more time in the field?
Well, first of all, our own people, in some instances, have been doing it, as you're aware, for the last 2 weeks. Second place, I would hope that all of our people could learn much from precept and example. I think the example set by Ambassador Galbraith in India is one that could well be emulated by other ambassadors in posts all around the world. I think that we need to know the people of other nations, and more important for them to know us. I know the President feels and the Secretary of State feels that the people-to-people approach that was followed in connection with our mission is a very desirable one, and we would hope to some degree to be followed by our leadership in the diplomatic field.
Dow of Associated Press. I wonder if you could assess for us give us your opinion on the effect of the rioting concerned with the Freedom Riders on world opinion itself.
I never heard the subject discussed until I was asked the question in Bermuda yesterday. In my visit to Africa a little more than a month ago, the distinguished Prime Minister of Senegal said to me that he was very happy that this administration was taking responsible steps to erase certain discriminations that had been practiced in our country and to protect the constitutional rights of all people. I think that it was not mentioned to me on this trip, so I cannot speak for what may have been in the minds of any people who did not discuss it with me. For myself, I would say that President Kennedy and I were elected on a platform to protect the full constitutional rights of all of our citizens, that we have taken whatever steps we thought necessary to ensure those guarantees, that we do not believe that any person should be deprived of his constitutional rights because of his race, religion, or the region in which he lives, and that is the policy of this administration and one that will be followed by this administration during its entire tenure.
Roberts of the Washington Post. Could you tell us, sir, whether, as you traveled through these countries and talked to these leaders, you made any commitments on behalf of the president or the administration?
Yes. Yes, we. Before I left here, I, at the president's request, agreed to go to certain countries. In each instance, the president surveyed our relations with that country and prepared a letter for his signature for me to deliver to the head of state of each of those countries. In all of those letters, the president made commitments and stated the policy of this administration. I delivered those commitments and stayed within them. But to avoid any speculation that might take place after I left the country, I thought it desirable to have a joint communique issued that would encompass the commitments made in the president's letter or made by me orally upon his authorization. And in each instance, that was done, so that anyone who cares to speculate need not do so. The commitments are there in the joint communiques themselves. And the communiques were taken from the president's letter. And even though they came from the letters, in most instances where they involved anything substantive, we cleared them with Washington before they were released.
When you told us that in none of these countries was there any request for American troops, they had the manpower, can we conclude that the intervention of American armed forces in that area is excluded?
Certainly say that there's no plan or no intention at this time. There's no request from any nation for troops. None was made, and of course no promise was given. I would not want to forever foreclose the possibility of America protecting her interests wherever it might be. But I've spoken frankly and candidly and truthfully with you, and I repeat, no nation asked for American troops. No nation was promised American troops. There's no plan for American troops in any of the area involved.
Vice President, you mentioned the example of Ambassador Galbraith in New Delhi getting to the people. For the benefit of those of us who were not with you on the trip, could you tell us a little more about his technique?
Well, first, Ambassador Galbraith is a very skilled Democrat, diplomat. And very democratic in his personal relations. He's an outstanding economist that has a curiosity for all that takes place in the country that he serves. He goes out in his shirt sleeves among the people who till the soil, talks to them about their problems. He goes into the schoolrooms and exchanges viewpoints with them. He in his democratic manner, relates his impressions to his own staff and to the officials of the government to which he is assigned as a representative, as well as to other ambassadors and to other governments. It's a very fine example of democracy in action. I went with him one entire day. We visited a village that had been remade and rebuilt, and we went to one that had not been remade and rebuilt. We compared the two. We went to a housing project. We went to an agricultural school and participated in the dedication of that school, all far removed from New Delhi and quite different from the atmosphere and surroundings there. I learned much from him myself and tried to apply what I'd learned in my other visits, and I'm sure that other ambassadors will do likewise.
In your earlier remarks, you said something about making sure that our funds or our aid does not go to dictators and aristocrats. Could you elaborate on that a little and tell us what measures you're proposing to prevent that in the future?
We discussed with each leader of government how pleased we were at some of the reforms that had taken place, and the results of a commission that's set up in, say, China, in land reform, where we had representatives and where they had representatives, and where we had proceeded to buy land from its owners and pay a reasonable price, and then to sell that land for 2.5 times its annual yield. Say it yields $100 a year, we'd sell it for $250, 2.5 times its annual yield, and that would be paid for over a 10-year period at $25 a year. Now, that commission that operated in cooperation with the government has done very effective work. We saw a cooperative venture in Karachi, a housing venture that I have alluded to, where the Ford Foundation and the United States government and the government of Pakistan and some Greek architects made great contributions, where they had all gone together and developed a housing project where a man who earns less than $20 a month could have 2 rooms and a bath and a toilet for $3 a month. And at the end of 20 years, that home would be his. By combination of those four instrumentalities, had economized every way we could and had, we thought, made great savings and had circumvented any possibility of waste or any charge that any of these funds might go to supporting governments that were democratic or undemocratic. We stressed with each government America's intense interest and the president's intense interest in improving the standard of living and educating the children and improving the health measure, improving the housing, because where men have things to fight for, they're willing to fight and die, but they're not willing to fight to perpetuate poverty and disease and $40 a year per capita income. And in each instance, we received sympathetic consideration from our government. So as a consequence, from the government leaders, and as a consequence, there will be appointed shortly leaders by the President and the Secretary of State who will be experts in fiscal and economic matters, who will give advice and guidance to various governments in connection with our programs in those areas. And I might also say that the President assured me this morning that in order to permit a stepped-up program of military and economic assistance in some of the nations visited, particularly Vietnam and Thailand and Pakistan, that he is sending a message to Congress tomorrow. And there will be included in that message something over an additional $100 million over and above the program planned a few weeks ago for those countries in order to strengthen their defenses and in order to improve their economic program.
Mr. President, in your talks with Indian Prime Minister Nehru, did you discuss with him or did he show any interest at all in an Indian contribution to the security of Southeast Asia?
Yes, we discussed it. I think that's reflected in our communique. We expressed our appreciation for the contribution that he had made in connection with the Laotian matter. We urged him at the request of the President to extend his leadership to other areas in Southeast Asia and to try to cooperate with the other leaders of government and to exchange viewpoints and try to solidify the peace-loving nations in that area. And I think it was his language. I don't want to misquote him, but I think he said that after those conferences, we hit it off pretty well, unquote. And I was very appreciative of the contribution he made and his willingness to be helpful wherever peace is involved, and particularly helpful in connection with improving the standard of living for all the people of the world.
Mr. President, in addition to discussing with the leaders the hope of the United States to further the economic plight of these people, was there any discussion, sir, to form any guerrilla-type activities to combat the guerrilla activities of the communists that you mentioned and laid a fair amount of importance on in your opening statement?
No, I did not go into specific military actions. I am no expert in that field. That is a matter for the government's concern. I have no doubt but what our government, and certainly each government that we visited, is determined to do whatever is necessary to resist the encroachment of the communists and to resist communist aggression. I might point out to you that we have a choice in this country. You have a choice and I have a choice. We have two alternatives. We can turn our face and our back and pull in our interests into Honolulu and San Francisco and rely on Fortress America, or we can try to help with our money and with our counsel those nations who have the manpower and the determination and the will to resist communism. Now, of the two choices, it's not even close in my book, and I think that all Americans should know that we're going to have to make those choices. It's going to be expensive. It's going to involve sacrifices. I have no desire to pull in America's horns and walk out on our commitments and forget our treaties and to turn our back on our fellow men who are ready and willing and anxious to preserve freedom and liberty in their area. So I believe it's the wish of the people of America, and I know it is the decision of the President of the United States and his administration to see to it that we provide such assistance, military, economic, and political, as may be desirable and necessary to see that freedom is preserved in not just America, but in Vietnam, in Thailand, in Southeast Asia, and the areas we covered.
Sir, did you find in your investigations of India that there was any increase in communistic organization there?
No, I'm not an expert on the number of communists in any given country. I think that Mr. Nehru has a very stable government. I think that there are communists in all the areas we visited, but I do not think that they have any great chance of success, and I do not think they will be successful if America does her part and does it in time.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
You've been listening to a news conference by Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, in which the Vice President reported on his mission just completed to South and Southeast Asia. The program originated live in the auditorium of the State Department in Washington.
An important speech by President Kennedy before a joint session of Congress, live tomorrow on NBC Radio.